in this conversation.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another Revenue Committee meeting, which we are convening. We have some information sessions this morning on issues that are perennial favorites that seem to recur constantly, and we continue to work on them. Paul, are we starting with timber payments?
Yes, we are.
Thank you. Christine, you want to...
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christine Broniak from the Legislative Revenue Office. Today, we're going to have an informational session on federal timber tax payments to counties. Historically, timber has been an important source of revenue to counties to fund many of their services, both shared and services that are provided exclusively by the county. The timber payments, as harvests drop off, are currently becoming more and more uncertain into the future. It had been, the payments had been authorized under the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act in 2000, and the act had provided for a step down of revenues, a ramp down over time. And as the future, as we move forward, the revenues are uncertain. So today we have Mike MacArthur from the Oregon Association of Counties, or the Association of Oregon Counties, and Doug Robertson as a Douglas County Commissioner to talk about the potential revenue problems that can come from the loss of federal timber tax payments.
Thank you, gentlemen. Please.
Morning, Chair Berger, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Mike MacArthur, the Executive Director of Association of Counties. We have a presentation this morning on the county timber payments issue. I know that some of you are familiar with it, but we have a new and improved presentation, which Eric's going to help lead me through here. So we appreciate the opportunity to do this today. This is a very important program. Brings in about, at its height, about $230 million to the state from outside our economy to replace that income that was previously garnered from cutting trees. The map that we're going to show you this morning shows the public lands in the state of Oregon. You may have seen it before. The green areas are the U.S. Forest Service. The beige areas are the Bureau of Land Management. Some of the beige is the ONC lands in the western part of the state, and the beige in the eastern part of the state is rangeland managed by the Bureau of Land Management. The dark orange shows the state forest lands. Also, we have tribal reservations, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Refuge lands, and other smaller public lands designations. Point here is that 54% of the state is owned by the federal government. Much of that being federal forest or ONC. Of the rest, of the white, 93% is designated farmer forest, so it pays a much lower rate of property tax, which leaves about 3.22% of Oregon's total land base as taxable at full rate for, or at the Measure 50 rate, for to generate revenue for public services. So how did we get to this point? Well, we have the National Forest Act in 1907. The National Forest System was created when Gifford Pinchot became our first national forester and convinced President Roosevelt that we needed to set aside these forests for sustainable timber management. Pinchot was an advocate of sustainable forest management practices. But they recognized that taking these lands into federal ownership, we're removing them from the tax base. So in 1908, Congress passed the National Forest Revenue Act, which provided sharing the revenue from the forest lands with the counties for schools and roads. Likewise, in 1937, the ONC Act, Oregon, California, revested lands. There was a railroad that was being built from Oregon to California, and in the tradition of those times, the railroad company was given every other section to help finance the cost of the railroad. They didn't abide by the federal law that was in place at the time in the way they were supposed to dispose of those lands, and so in 37 or so, The federal government took them back, passed the ONC Act. And Doug can tell you more about that. Doug is the chairman of the Oregon-California Lands Association. The revenues from the ONC Act are different than the Forest Service. Those revenues go directly to the general funds of the counties involved. The Forest Service revenues go to roads and schools. ONC money goes to the general fund. 18 Oregon counties contain ONC lands. They're the only counties in the United States with this type of land within their borders. The counties later agreed to return 25% of those receipts to the Bureau of Land Management to manage the ONC lands. So the ONC counties received 50% of the revenue from those lands to their general funds. So in the 1990s, we went along from 1908 through the 1990s with revenue flowing from the sale of timber to the counties for road, schools, and general fund. But in the 90s, we had the spotted owl situation. So as a result of the huge curtailment of logging during the 90s, we had the Clinton Forest Plan, which brought funding to the western Oregon counties in to help try and restart their economies. That gave way in 2000 to the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, which for 6 years provided a level of payments to the counties to replace those federal forest payments. 41 states nationwide shared in those revenues from the act. And then in 2007, there was a one-year extension of that act. 2008, another extension was passed, but this time it was funded at a lower level and ramped down. So we have the chart there showing the ramp down. So you see the light blue or purple is the first 7 years, and then in the darker blue we see the first years of the ramp down. So where we are now is federal year 11, and what the counties will receive in December, January of this year is the last blue bar. And if nothing happens at the congressional level, we'll be to the red in the next budget year in the 12-13 budget year for counties. So why should the state care about this? Counties and service delivery mechanisms for the state. So all that you see in red there in this famous chart are the services that we deliver on behalf of the state, often with county funds involved. Many counties provide general funds to supplement state funding. This practice will end with the elimination of the federal forest payments. In fact, some counties are talking about returning services to the state. Douglas County has already returned community corrections. Public health is also in great danger of being returned to the state. County budgets are severely impacted by this. You can see the most hard-hit counties. Douglas County, for instance, Doug can tell you about, gets 65% of its general fund revenue from either timber harvest or the supplemental federal payments from ONC and Forest Service, in the case of Douglas County. So you can see the list of counties and how that affects their general funds. 21 counties will lose more than 20% of their road funds. 11 counties will lose more than half of their road funds. The judge in Wheeler County tells me when we get to 12-13, they won't have a road department. Then we have unsustainable counties. There are counties that have, some counties have reserves, have planned for the possible loss of these payments. Many counties we studied took those four-year payments and averaged them, those last 4 years' payments and averaged them, and then tried to put a little bit aside for what happens beyond that. But we think that some counties are right on the edge. We've done a study of what it takes per capita to run a county, and we think it's just at the very basic, bare bones level, and we think it's about $160 per person. There are counties that are going to dip below that level soon. And those are, these are some of the ones that we consider the most critical. So we have a map here that shows the hard-hit counties in the state. They're in the red. The white counties, of course, never have received any timber revenue. The beige counties are more severely hit, and the green are not so severely impacted. So that brings us to today, and where are we with efforts to reauthorize? We've continued the efforts, realizing that that four-year ramp down wasn't going to be sufficient, and that there has been no significant increase in timber harvest over all this time. Many thought that during this period of time, either counties would change their economies or we would find a way to begin to manage federal forests in a way that brought revenue to the counties. Neither of those have happened. So in 2008, Curry County was near panic mode and issued a state of emergency declaration and sent it to the governor and said, we have an economic emergency pending. And the governor's office took a look at that and said, well, yeah, we think what happens to the county does affect the state. And so we convened the Federal Forest Payments and County Services Task Force and met for a year and a half and issued this report, which you can find on the web. And it's a great resource today, even so, with all the information that's in here. It was co-chaired by Tim Nesbitt, the governor's deputy chief of staff, and Bobby Green, then Lane County commissioner. We spent a lot of time looking at this, and the conclusions really were you can't replace $230 million worth of federal revenue coming into the state in any one way. And it really has to be a combination of things that can be done. The state could help with some of the services. There's a number of services that counties provide on behalf of the state that could be shifted more to the state if the state had income, which it does, we know, we understand. We could do a better job of managing the federal forests, and we've done some work toward that. It seems that establishing collaboratives and trying to get agreement up front on timber sales is the only thing that's really working right now, and we've worked to try and establish more of those collaboratives. The ONC has some very innovative ideas about what could be done with those lands, and Doug may talk about that. And finally, you know, the federal government has a responsibility here, and they should be stepping up. And so the good news is there is a marker in the president's budget that would provide a continuation of funds for four more years, but the first year of the president's proposal is 10% below that lowest bar on the graph. So there's an active campaign nationwide to get these Congress to step up and fund this program until we can find a better way out of this. But right now, given the situation in Washington, D.C., who knows? So let me turn it over to Commissioner Robertson and let him talk about the campaign itself.
Mike, thank you. Representative Berger, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and visit with you a little bit this morning. Mike has done an excellent job of giving you the framework of...
Commissioner, can you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Doug Robertson. I'm a commissioner in Douglas County and also chairman of the Association of ONC Counties and co-chair, actually vice chair of the Federal Forest Counties and Schools Coalition, the national organization that Mike mentioned. This morning, I'm going to try to provide a little context of what's going on with the campaign, where we are, the obstacles we face, what progress we've made, and hopefully where we're headed. We are, as Mike pointed out, attempting to get into legislation what will actually be a fifth iteration of the reauthorization, the first being in 1993 with the Omnibus Reconciliation Act. And again, as Mike pointed out, we've had three subsequent reauthorizations. When this current reauthorization runs out at the end of 2011. We are proposing a 10-year reauthorization at 2008 levels. that will affect the 41 states that are involved, over 700 counties nationwide. There's a concerted effort nationally in trying to achieve this. Certainly, the Association of Oregon Counties very involved, not only in terms of touching bases with other states, but also financially. The Association of O&C Counties very involved. The Federal Forest Counties and Schools Coalition on a national basis, very active in this effort. And to that end, we have formed the Partnership for Rural America, which is the campaign effort to encourage those in other states to join Oregon, Washington, California, and Idaho in this effort. There are several challenges. One of the biggest challenges that we faced in our previous efforts was to encourage other parts of the country to become active in soliciting support from the administration in getting a reauthorization passed. As you know, Senator Wyden, Senator Merkley, very involved with Congressman DeFazio, Congressman Walden, and Congressman Schrader in particular. But being very involved also put a tremendous amount of pressure on those representatives and senators because Oregon is such a large receiver of the money. Oregon receives over half of the entire national allotment for this for this safety net, as well we should. We have 13 national forests and 2.3 million acres of O&C lands. Oregon actually gets two safety nets. They get an O&C safety net, again, as Mike described, discretionary funding for our general fund, and also a safety net that comes from the Forest Service for roads, bridges, and to be shared with education. Our effort, to a large extent, as I mentioned, has been to broaden the interest and the concern throughout the country so that there isn't so much pressure on those representing us in the Oregon delegation. And to that end, we have been successful in the Southeast with West Virginia, Arkansas, Mississippi, Georgia, Florida. And although these states are not huge receiving states, their rural education is dramatically affected by this bill, and that's why they have been willing to come to the table. And we've made several trips to those areas, and have generated very high interest, and that's been very helpful. In addition to that, states in the Southwest, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, also big receiving states who are now on the playing field. Recently, Senator Baucus and Senator Tester from Montana sent a very pointed letter to the president indicating that Montana, on a per capita basis, was the largest receiving state of these funds. And that's very, very helpful because, again, it takes some of the pressure off of the Oregon delegation who is trying their best. But, again, it's the big receiving state. It's obvious that they're going to be supportive. So we're continuing to work. One of the goals that we had and started work on very early in the fall was to get recognition in the president's budget. Very important because it is a signal that the administration sees this issue as important and is a signal to Congress that they are also willing to help try to identify some offsets. And we'll talk about offsets in a minute because as the assets, political assets that we have increased, so have the challenges because of the budget situation on the federal level. But a mention in the president's budget was very important, and it's regardless of what it was, it is a five-year ramp down. It is undoubtedly going to be changed, but simply the recognition that this is an important issue was what we were hoping for and gave us a step up. So we're going forward, and the biggest challenge that we're facing now is identifying an offset. This 10-year reauthorization has a price tag of $6.3 billion nationwide. That's a pretty big number. And it's also a big challenge in no small part due to the new rules that Congress has put on themselves in terms of identifying offsets. We all know what PAYGO is. PAYGO is if you have a program like ours, show us how you're going to pay for it. And while that posed some concerns, that at least gave us some direction and we had some idea of areas to look for money. In addition to PAYGO, Congress has now adopted something called CUTGO. And CUTGO makes the bar a little higher. And just as an example of what CUTGO is, in Oregon and many other states, there is a program called CRP, the Conservation Reserve Program. It's a program where the Department of Agriculture actually pays farmers, ranchers, and landowners to take land out of production put in a wildlife status. And along with that, they have public hunting and so on. But they're paid to do that. And in years past, and we'll use an example of, say, $1 billion was allocated for this program. Oftentimes, when programs like this are allocated, not all the money is spent. And at the end of the year, for instance, in this instance, if only half of the money was spent, that would have left $750 million on the table. In times past, we could have identified that as a way to pay for this program. You can't do that anymore. Any of those reserve funds, any of those funds unexpended, now have to go to deficit reduction. So when you come to Congress with a plan like we have for reauthorization, you also have to come and identify how you're going to pay for it with real money. Well, to that end, we have been, and when I say we, I'm talking about the Association of O&C Counties, the 18 counties in Western Oregon that contain the O&C lands. We've been working with our congressional representatives, the Department of Interior, for many years on how best to manage these lands within the prescribed legal sideboards. They're obviously, as Mike again has pointed out, very important to us because those funds are discretionary. We have come up with a plan that identifies, and remember, we're talking about a 2.3 million acre land base. We've come up with a plan that identifies about half of those acres, 1,170,000 acres, with the oldest timber, the old growth on those lands, to be set aside in a permanent old growth reserve to be managed for old growth ecosystems. In addition, the remaining 1,200,000 acres would be sold into the private sector. The sale of that land over a 3 to 5 year period would generate about $6 billion. That would offset at least half of a 10-year reauthorization, understanding that half of that money would be put in a reserve fund for the benefit of the O&C counties, producing interest that would approximate what we're getting in the safety net today. It would create thousands of new jobs, provide a sustainable flow of raw material for the wood products industry, and as I said, get the counties out from the middle of this issue of every year wondering if we're going to have budgets or not, which I don't have to point out to you is a very difficult way to run your business. It's available on a website. It's the Federal Forest Counties and School Stabilization Act, FFCSSA.org. I would encourage you to take a look at it. It does offer the opportunity for real money to offset the program and the reauthorization that we're talking about. Well, I could go on and on about the problems we're having, but why don't we stop, and if you have questions or thoughts, we'll certainly try to do our best to answer them.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this presentation. Questions from the committee? Yes.
Just one. What's the reality of actually selling off that land? I mean, what's the real political environmental reality of doing that?
Well, good question. I think it's obviously a challenging plan. The sale of any land in the federal state brings real challenges. The other side of that is that the ONC lands exist only in Oregon. Even though they're the Oregon-California revested grant lands, there aren't any in California or Washington or anywhere else. So it's an Oregon-centric issue. You may remember when this issue came before Congress 4 years ago, then Undersecretary Mark Ray floated a plan to sell Forest Service lands to underwrite this program. That ran into a brick wall. Because it was a situation where if you're in Tennessee or Texas, where you have Forest Service lands, you're saying, now, wait a minute, you're going to sell part of my forest to fund what is generally a program that with huge benefits in the state of Oregon? Why would we do that? All the other 41 states have Forest Service lands. None of them have ONC lands. What our proposal does is just the reverse. Say, let Oregon, who has been a huge beneficiary of this program, help the other 40 states. From that perspective, there is interest. You may also have noted, as the president opened the discussion about his budget, he mentioned the sale of federal land. That's the first time we've heard a president do that. The reality is that Congress is beginning to realize that using our own assets to pay for our own needs is something we're going to have to face. These lands were all in private ownership for 40 years. There were three efforts by the federal government to get them sold into the private sector. They are very unique historically, legally, and obviously physically. They are not large blocks of contiguous forest land. They're bits and pieces and chunks of a checkerboard that's heavily eroded and to a large extent have already been heavily logged. So this is a different proposal. We're getting some traction in Congress. Not the least reason is because the realization that somebody's going to have to come up with some real money. And this is one of the very few offsets that would actually score.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I don't know if you've mentioned it yet, but I have observed on the ground some of the management failures of the BLM in managing the ONC lands, either for production or for anything else. There are stands of timber in my district on ONC lands that have not been thinned and are and very quickly won't be marketable because of the death of trees, because they planted them overly thickly and failed to do the thinning that should have been done 15 years ago. I can see a lot of advantages of getting some of those lands that are interspersed with private lands now because of the checkerboard pattern into stronger management hands for the purpose of both maintaining the health of the forest and producing income. I think we can do both. I don't think that the BLM has demonstrated that they're able to with those lands. So I see it an additional advantage to the proposal that you're talking about from the standpoint of the health of Oregon's forests, as well as our ability to generate employment and some revenue for the counties. If the funds are held in trust, as you suggest, then that may deal with our problem. Do you have any comment about what I've just said?
Yes.
It may not be a useful thing to say in Congress, what I just said.
No, it actually...
But I think it does comport to the facts.
The reality Representative Barnhart, is that these lands cannot be managed for their stated purposes under the federal authority. They simply can't be managed. And I've had the opportunity to talk to the Secretary of Interior and make it very clear that his land managers don't manage the land anymore. They manage paper and process and litigation. These lands cannot be managed. When you combine Recovery Action 32 in the Northwest Spotted Owl Plan, with survey and manage, with consultation, with lawsuits, protests, and appeals, these lands can't be managed. From the beginning to end, when the BLM identifies 100 acres that they want to sell timber on, the planning process, the implementation process, when you actually get logs in the ground, takes 8 years. The system's broken, clearly. And as long as these lands are under the management of the federal government, they will not be managed for their stated purposes. They can't be. It isn't because the Bureau of Land Management or district managers or state director doesn't want to manage them. They do want to manage them, but they simply can't. And this plan, whether they are sold into the private sector, whether they're put under the authority of a nonprofit corporate structure, whether they went to the state of Oregon, there are several different models under which they could be managed. But as long as they're under the federal government, they will not, cannot be managed for their stated purposes.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Wan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as part of this plan, if it's successful and these timberlands are sold to private owners, have you calculated the tax base from the ownership of these lands by a private owner and made sure that that is a sustainable tax base for the timber counties?
The tax base is negligible. They're really, because of the deferrals, is very little in the way of tax base. Our dollars would come from the sale of the land, put into trust, and the remaining $3 billion would go to the federal government to help offset the 10-year reauthorization or pay completely for a 5-year reauthorization for the entire country. But the tax issue is negligible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ignoring the ONC lands for a minute, what is it that would distinguish the concept for Oregon from all the other states with large federal inholdings?
Well, the fact that there are no other lands that have the unique characteristics of the ONC lands in any other state. They don't exist in any other state.
Well, so you're asking a different question, aren't you?
My question was ignoring the ONC lands.
Yes. Accepting that.
Accepting them out. Yeah, leave them out of the equation. Is there anything that distinguishes Oregon from any in Nevada, which has 80% federal land?
No. No, other than the fact that the amount of forest land that we have in this state is unique, as the amount of desert in Nevada is unique. But as far as federal ownership, about half of Oregon, as you know, is owned by the federal government and managed by the federal government. So in that regard, we're very similar to many, many other states.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
The concept then is dependent entirely upon the ONC land distinction.
Yes.
And that distinction is exactly what? The fact that either the management issue, or is it the fact that once it was in private hands and came back to the federal government? What's the actual essential element that makes those lands different?
Well, both of what you describe, plus the 1937 ONC Act, which makes the ONC lands and the ONC Act a dominant use act, unlike the Forest Service. The National Forest Management Act is a multiple use act. That applies to the other 40 states, including Oregon. The ONC lands are managed under a dominant use act, that dominant use being the production of timber within the principles of sustained yield for the benefit of the counties in which they're located. So the federal law makes them very unique, very different legally, historically, and of course, as I mentioned, physically, they're very different.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That being the case, how come the counties haven't filed suit against the government to force them? Have they? And if so, what's the outcome?
We have. We've been successful. In 1990, Association of OMC Counties defended a case brought by the Headwaters Organization in Southern Oregon, claiming that the OMC lands were actually multiple use. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that not to be the case, that indeed they were dominant use. Congress was very clear on how they were to be managed. The problem is not the fact that we won the court case. The problem is all the intervening laws, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, provide the opportunity for lawsuits, appeals, on any action brought by the Department of Interior to manage these lands. So it's the overlay of the federal rules, restrictions, regulations, and requirements that have basically shut down the management, not just of the ONC lands, but of the Forest Service as well.
Yep, please.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the concept is that somehow by transferring ownership, we would avoid those very laws that you just mentioned?
Yes. Well, we would avoid NEPA. We would avoid many of the issues that present the opportunity for legal action under the Oregon Forest Practices Act instead of under the National Environmental Policy Act. Very important distinction.
And my final question.
Yeah.
Thank you. The political issue Representative Eric Brewer raised earlier then would be maybe refined to ask why the Congress would allow these lands to be removed from the purview of those, the NEPA and other federal laws designed for the protection of what most folks see as federal ownership. So what is the argument to overcome that particular maybe argument?
When we're confronted with that, again, we refer to the legal history of these lands, what they are for. They are not Forest Service lands. They are not multiple-use lands. They are very specific in terms of how they're to be managed. And again, as I mentioned, for 40 years, they were all in private ownership. The odd checkerboard was never intended to be the ultimate physical nature of these lands. They were all intended to be in private ownership. The Chamberlain-Ferris Act in 1916 was designed to have these lands sold into the private sector. The Stansfield Act in 1926, the same thing. They weren't sold. They weren't all sold. About half of the lands that were originally identified for the railroad were sold in the private ownership. But because of the market conditions and so on, the lands were not sold, and in 1937 taken back into federal ownership. So there's a very unique history that's unique to the state of Oregon. And these lands aren't going to go anywhere. They would continue to be managed for their stated purpose, which is timber production. And as I mentioned in our plan, we're identifying and we recognize that the issue of old growth is a very contentious political issue, and that's why we've identified the acreage that contain 150 years and older stands of timber, about 1,170,000 acres, to be set aside so that there is a positive environmental consequence.
Representative Lyon. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have another one?
Yeah, I did have another one.
Please, okay.
The best argument then, your best argument for achieving the purpose, what is it? Is it to save the counties? Is it to generate economic activity? Is it to better manage the forest? What is the crux of the matter that's going to...
So you mentioned three of them.
All of them.
Create jobs, provide a sustainable flow of raw material for the wood products industry, provide a sustainable and predictable source of revenue for counties, and recognize the environmental amenities on the older forests. It's to take all of the stakeholders. Our premise in doing this, even though these lands all should be managed under the principle of sustained yield for the production of timber, was the recognition that with all of the stakeholders pulling one way or the other, whether it's the industry, whether it's the environmental organizations, or whether it's us, the counties, we're not going to get anywhere until we put a plan on the table that gives something of substance to everybody. Then we've got something to talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a comment. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't point out the irony here. So many of these environmental lawsuits and the folks chaining themselves to bulldozers come about, I think, ultimately from good intentions, from people wanting to save the forest. But the irony is that in so doing, what they have done is they have so impoverished the east and the south of our state that now we're looking at actually selling off of the very lands that those folks were intending to protect in the first place, because we simply have no other option. I see these types of strategies that you're moving forward with as an obligation on the part of those of us in the metro area to lend a helping hand. Our policies and our choices in the Portland area shouldn't lead to poverty in the east and the south. It's just not right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would urge committee members who haven't done so to go look at the checkerboard in my county. It is stark. The differences between the sections that are privately managed, those sections look like these are relatively low elevation lands in the rainforest, lots of water, good productive land. They may be able to produce trees very quickly. The privately held lands held by private timber companies look like Oregon rainforest. They have trees, they have clerestory trees, they have the kind of foliage you find on the ground in Oregon rainforest, ferns and rhododendrons and other things. If you look at the BLM land, immediately, the ONC land, immediately next door, you know, with straight line drawn sections, it's obvious, they're dark. You can't see, there's nothing, there are places you can't walk through them because of the trees growing too close together. There's nothing else in those trees. There's no viney maples. There are no, none of the trees that grow under the big trees. And none of the ground cover plants, except maybe very small ones that you have a hard time seeing unless you're right up close to them. I mean, it is stark. It is an astounding thing to see it. The management has been completely lacking, as far as I'm concerned, in these forests. I'm an environmentalist. I want these forests to be managed for environmental uses. They are not being managed that way now. And I'm convinced that in these high-growth, very productive lands, thinning the forest, doing a reasonable job of managing forest for timber production, as well as some of these other issues, means that you end up with much healthier forests than the forests we have now. I mean, that was the comment I was trying to make earlier. It is extremely disturbing to me that we have made such a botch of it in terms of federal management. One final comment on this piece, and then I want to hear from Alex Kyler. This is what you get when you have absentee landlords who really don't care about Oregon's forests. They come, their congressional people come from all over the country. A member from Maryland gets as much of a vote as Peter DeFazio does. By the way, Peter agrees with me about this issue, at least in general terms. And the key problem, it seems to me, is absentee ownership of these great forests of ours. As long as we have absentee ownership by a landlord who really has his attention focused somewhere else, we are going to be the stepchild of the United States. We are not going to get our forests managed well. I believe that if we fought it out right here between the timber companies, the environmentalists, and the other people with an interest, the people who want clean water in the cities, that we would have a much better outcome than we're getting because of federal neglect. Alex, your comment, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart. Members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. Lane County, one of the top receivers of Secure Rural Schools dollars in the country, along with Douglas County. We've been part and parcel of this issue for the last 100 years. Commissioner Robertson and I, Chairman Stewart from Lane County, we've been in D.C. multiple times, typically 4, 5, 6 times a year to visit on this issue. There is an incredible history on these lands, and I think you've heard a lot about the ONC Act. I want to bring just one thing to the attention of the committee that I didn't hear in the previous testimony, and it may, Representative Benz, get to your question about sort of the uniqueness if you take the ONC lands out of the picture. And that is that the school funding situation and the Forest Service lands. In Lane County, we actually split dollars between the ONC lands and the United States Forest Service lands, roughly 50-50. But you've heard that those ONC dollars are fully discretionary. The Forest Service dollars are not. Those dollars go into road fund and to school fund, county school funds, and then those county school funds get distributed to rural schools, well, all schools in the county where those dollars are generated per a formula. And that is considered local revenue under Measure 5 and 50. Okay, so we've got that, I think, is the uniqueness here, is that if you look back at the history of the revenue picture over time, we passed those property tax capping acts at a time when we were reaping more revenue off the forest than any time in history. So you've got the mindset of the voter, perhaps, who's thinking there's plenty of money here, not fully understanding the role that these federal forests play in funding public services, including schools, public safety, infrastructure. And so we passed these acts when we had a fair amount of revenue coming in, the largest amount of revenue coming in from our Forest Service lands, and not seeing in the future that this money could actually dry up through some of the actions that you've heard earlier today. And I think that's part of the uniqueness here. If you look, Representative Barnhart, Representative Gelser, at some of your schools, in your, especially your rural schools, I'm on the budget committee at Pleasant Hill. Right, that's the third largest source of dollars is coming in from the county school fund. And in a little school, you know, when you are faced with watching these dollars in a line item, every single school across the state, I think it's 2804, has got that federal forest fees, and you watch that thing going down, 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 and in Pleasant Hill, well, we see it go down about $70,000 a year. That's a teacher. Okay, and when you only have two teachers in a grade, or in a smaller district, one teacher in a grade, that's huge. It's really, and luckily, in a way, I say luckily, I mean, we've now gotten to the point where this is so acute that the school districts are now saying, okay, this is a big deal. We've had Superintendent Castillo write a letter to the White House on behalf of the Secure Rural Schools Act reauthorization. We had George Russell from the Eugene School District write a letter to the White House on the same issue. And we are seeing now teachers, I mean, this is not called the Secure Rural Schools Act for nothing. This is now starting to see, in spite of Measure 5 with equalization, because it is a local revenue, we're starting to get engaged on that issue. But it's another piece of this that I think the legislature needs to be very much aware of, because it does have implications for your school funding picture.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you briefly referenced this, but I think it is important to, again, acknowledge the way that our state school funding formula works. So that impacts not just the small schools, not just the rural schools, but all of the schools. It goes into the pot like the other property taxes. So exactly. As we lose those funds, it's not just a rural school. It's not just a Timber County. It is Portland. It's every place. It reduces everyone's per student ADM.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that's an important point. Anything else for Alex? Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation today very much. And good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next item.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. And our second item today for the presentation is some information about the CAFA program. The program had been established to fund county assessment and taxation functions The sources of revenue include both delinquent interest and recording fees and the transfer of property. With recent economic conditions, there is reduced transactions of property and housing, and this really has affected this recording fee revenue. We saw 2 years in a row of roughly 16% to 18% declines, and here today we have John Phillips to talk about that, as well as Bob Broman from the Clackamas County.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and we were asked to come talk today about the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Account. I always have to think through each letter because there's so many letters involved with this acronym. But essentially, think of this as a grant program. It's a voluntary program that counties can elect to participate in. All 36 are eligible. It essentially helps counties' property tax administration. And property tax, you know, as we've talked about, is the critical or sole source of revenue for approximately 1,400 local governments for the purposes that have been already stated today. Counties are statutorily mandated to, and even before statehood, statutorily mandated or territorially mandated to provide this service similar to the Department of Revenue's role in assessing and collecting income taxes and those other kinds of taxes on behalf of the state's general fund. The state relies on assessment and taxation for about 40 plus cents per dollar of the education funds in the state coffers. And I'll just kind of run you a little bit, very briefly, through the background of the program. Let's see, as soon as I can figure out here. Origin of the program. There was a study done back in the 80s. It was called the Disintegration Report, aptly named because the programs were disintegrating. There was a situation where we looked at what was happening to the county assessment and taxation programs. About 26 of 36 counties at that time were behind in their appraisals for years, some for years. Counties had laid off 30% of their appraisal staff they'd lost. And they were unable to keep up in many counties with what we call segregations, which means anytime property is subdivided, they make a note of it. They're going to follow up on that. They're going to change the tax lot maps, and then the correct people are going to get the tax statements. Well, they didn't have staff to work those, and so accounts were wrong. There was a lot of inequities because they weren't able to get out to properties, and this generated a work group that put together a bill that resulted in House Bill 2338. That was in 1989. It created this program, and essentially, like I said, it provides grant money for stability, equality, and uniformity was the goal. The funding for CAFA comes from what was at that time a $20 document recording fee on property transactions and an increased interest on delinquent property taxes. The other side of that is, here's the money. Now, how is it going to be delivered? How is it going to be processed? Essentially, it created a grant process where counties each year would apply for participation in the grant. They say, we would like to participate in this program, and here is our plan for our assessment and taxation functions. It also gave the Department of Revenue responsibility to oversee that, to review the grants, to approve the grants, deny the grants, and then to distribute the money appropriately. Transfers responsibility also, because of the overburdened counties, one of the issues discussed there was the highly complex industrial accounts, and so the department at that time was given responsibility to appraise those high-value industrial accounts. Excuse me. The sunset for the CAFA program, it was sunset, and in House Bill 2139 in 1999, it was continued. Essentially, in that 99 legislation broadened the base of the recording fees, and it lowered the fee to $10 instead of $20, and then broadened the base so it came on more properties. We also established what's called the ORMAP program, which is a program statewide that would help counties digitize all of their maps so that it would create a seamless map of Oregon that could be updated electronically rather than having to ship paper maps everywhere, draw lines, erase lines, and bring us more into the century. The 99 legislation also brought in a separate $5 million biennium appropriation that was just simply given to the Department of Revenue to put into this CAFA fund, and then the CAFA fund was distributed according to whoever participated in the grant program. It increased the stability of the funding and acknowledges a little bit the idea that the money that's collected and assessed for local governments also goes to schools, which is a function of state responsibility too. Essentially, the monies are distributed quarterly in proportion to the relative share. The $5 million appropriation was dropped in 2009 because of funding issues at the state level. Essentially, just nuts and bolts. The county says, okay, we're going to have this many appraisers. We're going to, perform these functions. This is how many staff we're going to have. This is how we're going to process things. And we review those grants for adequacy. We don't review them to say, oh, okay, well, you've got an adequate program, but we think you should add 10 more people. It's basically the bottom line is the program adequate? If it's sub-adequate, then we will talk to the commissioners and the assessor about thinking about ways to get the job done more effectively. We notify the county of steps that they might need to take to achieve adequacy, and they may submit an amended budget, or they may certify inadequate expenditures with a written compliance plan, which gives them a chance to come in back into compliance with adequacy. There are some counties, although it doesn't happen very often in these days, but that provide more revenue than might be necessary to run their program, and so those aren't funded in the program, and their proportions aren't set up with the super adequate type program. Although you'll find counties, and the county assessors can talk more specifically about this, that, after a 10 or 15 year period, they might have to get a new software program. And so in certain years, they'll have additional funding requirements just because of technology or things like that. If a county does not submit a program that's adequate, the Department of Revenue by law has to step in and assume the county valuation responsibilities. This has not happened yet. The cost, if this does happen, and we were looking very closely at a couple of counties last year, and we're looking at very closely at those counties again this year. They've talked about Curry County being in a very desperate situation. If it does happen, we would have to step in and do the appraisal function from the Department of Revenue, and the cost to reimburse the Department of Revenue comes from the monies that would otherwise go out to that county for other revenues that they get from the state, like I think liquor revenues, maybe transportation revenues, and that kind.
Cigarette?
I suspect. Never had to actually tap into those, but anyway. The results of the program over the years has been stabilization. Equity and uniformity was reestablished. That's been a little bit turned on its head because of Measure 50 has removed some of the equity and uniformity. But in terms of actual appraisers getting out or studies being done of values countywide, we're seeing a lot more uniformity. Just reverse the downward trends in most of the measurements of performance. So we do have some measurements that we look at. And my final slide just talks about some of the dynamics with the CAFA program. The total revenues, as I said early on, the two sources of revenue are primarily the additional interest rate that comes from delinquent interest collections and the recording fee. The total of those two are down about $5 million from the 2002 level. So just looking at the past 8 or 9 years, we're down $5 million. The appropriation that was authorized in 99 was eliminated in the last part of 2008, so that $5 million is gone. The federal forest revenues you've just heard about are ratcheting down revenues for many of the timber counties. And the workload has increased, which reduces the actual funding to fund the program from the county's general fund. And the counties may turn over their programs to the state, which we're not really situated to manage. I think we could probably manage a county or two, depending on what the needs were, but we're not prepared to really take over any kind of process in any kind of scale. So just a little overview of the program, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Would that be... I suppose it depends on the individual county and the circumstances. I don't want you to speculate too much about that, but I can imagine that it might be simply maintaining a program that's already in place, redirecting revenues as you mentioned earlier, in order to pay for it.
Mr. Chair,
it might, on the other hand, be that you have to bring in people from other places in order to manage a program, depending upon what personnel are available.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. We, you know, not having been in that situation before, we think possibly, you know, there are some counties with the capacity maybe to actually run the tax roll for another county just because of the software capabilities they have. We don't have those functions because we don't have that responsibility, but there might be ways we could leverage things working with counties to figure out how to solve that problem. By law, we're only responsible, I believe, to take over this, the appraisal responsibility. So that leaves the question of who's going to work all the various exemption programs, who's going to process you know, people at the counter, obviously, and who's going to turn the tax roll and send out the statements, those kinds of things. So we would assume we kind of have to work that out between counties, maybe a regional solution or something like that.
Do you have the authority now to make those kinds of decisions at need, to write a contract with another county, for example, to manage the parts you talked about?
Mr. Chair, I believe we do, but okay. I will look into
that. Well, I mean, if you don't, we better make sure that we do it, right, that we figure out how to get it done.
Yes.
I do recall in 2003 when I was on this committee before, the state treasurer came in and we spent a lot of time working on his authority to issue warrants. Not because we thought we were going to do it, but because we thought we'd better be ready to do it if we had to.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you. Did you have...
I'll just add some comments. Chair Barnhart, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor and also the representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors.
Did you want to be heard? Okay. Come on up. Yeah. When my assessor comes, I want to make sure that she gets a chance if she wants.
And we always appreciate having Annette up here. right now, the counties are going through their budget processes, and certainly what we're looking at a lot of times are direction that would indicate either potential cutbacks in the general funding that. General fund monies from counties that are available to the assessment and tax program, and certainly there are some scenarios where they'll be asking counties potentially to make some serious cutbacks, which could ultimately jeopardize a county's ability to qualify for the CAFA grant. Like many governmental services, Oregon's property, or the administration of Oregon's property tax system, probably facing its most serious challenge in the 20 years since House Bill 2338 originally established the CAFA grant. The decline in the economy, and even though we're seeing some bright spots, certainly the slow recovery in the real estate area, along with the phase-in of the elimination of the secure rural school funding monies, certainly is creating a crisis situation in some counties and could jeopardize the administration of the property tax program in those counties. And I can tell you that I really appreciate, and we as an organization appreciate this committee and the legislature hearing our concerns about CAFA funding and the administration of the property tax system, because this system funds, as John mentioned, the 1,400 local governments that provide core services, including a significant share of the funding for K through 12, which the state certainly has a stake in. In fact, the property tax funds a broad category of services that are very similar in nature to what the state funds, including education, public safety, and human services. And I think John mentioned again in his overview that approximately 44 cents of the property tax dollar goes to funding the state education system. And I think that's in conjunction with about 54 cents out of every income tax dollar. So why is county funding for the A&T function in jeopardy? Well, there's really several primary reasons. And you've heard a little bit about some already, so I'll just go quickly. Certainly the recent downturn in the economy and the slow recovery from that downturn has led to a dramatic decline in new construction, which is one of the areas which allows for an increase in revenue that counties rely on often to cover the inflation in the costs of providing services and as well as cope with increasing the infrastructure and service demands. Certainly, the reduction and imminent loss of the timber monies in the Rural Secure Schools funding also exacerbates that situation. Recent state budget shortfalls put additional pressure on county budgets. When shared services are cut back as a result of the states having to cut back their contribution, that creates certainly an intense competition for those remaining funds that are available to, again, fund very core and very important services that not only the county provides, but local governments. Measure 5 and Measure 50, you can throw those in as certainly limiting counties' abilities to increase their revenue and thereby have additional funding to provide for services. And then, and I think you saw earlier in the presentation, federal, state, and local government holdings of a significant amount of property actually removes that property from being able to contribute to local taxing districts to fund the services that they provide. And here's a couple of areas where we think that, you know, this, we appreciate the fact that the state's taking a look. Property tax revenue that would otherwise go to local governments a lot of times is expended by the legislature in the form of tax expenditures or exemptions. And again, this creates some additional workload on the part of the counties and can limit revenue that's available to provide services. And finally, those legislative and certainly the initiative-driven measures that have changed our property tax statutes certainly increase the complexity and ultimately cost of administering the system and puts, again, heavier demands on funding to administer the system. I think John mentioned that we're in a time now that we've seen a tough economy. We've seen declining revenue that's being provided for in the CAFA funding program. At the height of the program, it provided about 36% of the cost of counties to actually fund the administration of the property tax system. We're down to about 20% and maybe a little bit less than that right now. And in 2009, we actually lost the state pass-through money of about $5 million that went to the counties in order to provide services. So I'd like to just thank you again for hearing this information about where we are now with the CAFA funding program, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, and maybe Annette would want to add something from County.
Any questions from the committee at this point? Would you like to add anything?
Sure. Good morning, Vice Chair Air Brewer and members of the committee. My name is Annette Spickard. I'm the Lane County Assessor, and I would just add to what John and Bob have already shared with you that the funding situations faced by many counties, and as you saw on the previous charts, Lane County is one of the counties that is in jeopardy with the loss or potential reductions of the secure rural schools funding from the federal government. And it's forcing some very serious debate at the local level around which constitutionally mandated priority the county is actually going to be able to do. And so not only are we facing some tough budgetary decisions and how we're going to cut back our budget, stay in compliance with what the Department of Revenue wants from us and our obligations to the taxpayers and to the tax districts, but there's conversations around the elections division, you know, and so, and that's also constitutionally mandated. And so it's an across-the-board discussion at our county about how much we're going to be able to remove from these mandated services and not be in violation of the Constitution at the end of the day, and things could possibly get worse after this next year. And so we, I think, can agree that we're all doing our very best to prioritize those critical core mandated services that we absolutely have to do as cost-effectively as possible. We're all very good at the use of technology and keeping the overall costs down per account in terms of what it takes to fulfill our cycle to create the tax statement and collect those dollars for our local schools and the government. But we are now at the point where we're having to engage in those conversations with our neighboring counties or other counties to see how we can collaborate and even share more and reduce costs more by working together. But it's a very tough situation, and I'm to appreciate that you're willing to hear about the situation only because of our tight partnership around school funding, because our ability to do our job well directly impacts the state school fund. So that's about all I have to add, but if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
No questions. Seeing none, thank you for your time. Oh, yes.
Madam Chair, if I can make one more comment.
Sure.
One thing I didn't mention, I don't think either Bob or Annette mentioned, was a little bit of the tension that goes on that might come to you as a representative from your county commissioners. And that is when they do their budget and they decide to make, let's say, across-the-board cuts or prioritize the county sheriff or something like that. They look at the assessor's office and the tax collector's office and they say, well, you know, they've got a tough decision. Are we going to have a deputy in the county 24/7 or not? Or are we going to fund an appraiser? And it gets to be, you know, what we hear, a very difficult choice. And then when the Department of Revenue says, you've got to hire the appraiser or you're going to lose your grant. They naturally, especially with incoming commissioners that are unfamiliar with this CAFA process, they're saying, why is the Department of Revenue telling us to hire an appraiser when we are trying to balance our budget here? And so it creates this tension that in normal times is not so bad. It's a healthy tension because they can leverage that 20%, but or what used to be 36, but in difficult times it gets to be a little bit of a strained conversation, and you might hear about it. So thank you.
Thank you for that. Has that happened recently in the last few years? Have you noticed that a lot more, that hard decision?
Madam Chair, absolutely. Yeah, every year. And we're, in fact, the presentation I just gave you is one we then end up taking out to the county commissioners to say, this is what it is. We get a new commissioner or strained budgets like many counties are going through right now. And yeah, every year we're out. Our administrator is going out, actually meeting with them and saying, you cannot cut these positions or you'll lose your grant. And it gets to be very heated at times.
Vice Chair Air Brewer, I can tell you from personal experience in Lane County that there were there was a large reduction of assessment and taxation staff after Measure 50 was passed in the mid-90s, like many of the counties had to implement, because there was about a 17% loss of tax revenue when that went into effect. In our county, we actually did fall behind in keeping up on the work to create an accurate tax roll every year, and so we did have accounts where people were being paying the wrong amounts. We did have accounts where people had partitioned or subdivided their property, and it took us up to 3 years to get that reflected on the tax roll just because we were so short-handed. And the compounding fallout from when you get into that hole is, you know, bad service to the taxpayer. The cost to correct the tax roll, as you've heard in a couple other bills, it's very complicated if we have to go back in time and correct a roll. It's just very inefficient to have to do that, and it is frustrating and confusing to the taxpayer. It degrades, I think, the public's trust in government when we can't even get the tax statement right. So we were in a bad situation in Lane County for many years because of being short-staffed, and that compounding effect of the errors on the roll and the loss of tax dollars to the local governments eventually resulted in 2004, the Department of Revenue did step in and did meet with the commissioners and did actually hold the line and say, okay, enough's enough. This is gotten bad, and we ended up adding 6 staff over 2 years and had a 3-year plan to eliminate that backlog and roll updates, and we actually got it all done, and we're totally current now, and everything's going fine, but it really took that intervention from the state to say this has gotten to the point we can't afford to do it like this anymore. And the county commissioners had to make that budget priority between our department and those obligations and other areas of the budget at that point, but it did pay off, and we were able to add quite a significant revenue stream in those first couple of years that benefited everybody once we were able to get that all caught up. So it does happen, and we do have some counties that are in jeopardy now, but it's our preference not to have to end up in that hole, because it is very difficult to get out of, and it costs a lot of money to have to get out of the hole when you get there. So I don't know if that helps, but yeah.
Vice Chair Erbrewer, if I could also just make one last comment, and it goes along with what both John and Annette, I think, have just told you. Most of what we do in the assessment and tax function is very heavily statutorily structured. And that's from the time we have to mail a tax statement to when we collect, when we distribute, and the type of work that we do. There's very little that we do that isn't statutorily or constitutionally mandated. And that's important, I think, when we talk about the reductions that many counties have already taken staffing level-wise over the years. At Clackamas County, we were staffed at a level that included almost 89 full-time equivalent people. We're now providing actually more service and completing a dramatically expanded workload with 57 and a half, basically, full-time equivalent staffing personnel. And so we have made and been able to make successful changes to very efficient methods, but we're getting down to rock bottom. And I think that's what I think needs to be emphasized when we're talking about that there are now counties that are in serious trouble in their ability to fund this function.
Your questions,
Sam? Yeah,
other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony this morning. Paul? All right. Committee, we have 35 minutes free time. Use them wisely. Committee is adjourned.
try to throw you something.